the content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading from Good Old Days magazine. Well, in honor of the recent snow that we've had, I am going to read some snow stories for you today. The first one, Snowpocalypse of 1967. More than 20 inches of snow meant no school, neighborhood shovel clearing, and an award-winning snowman. And this is submitted by Cindy Horgash. The Great Blizzard of 1967 was a kid's dream come true. It may have been a magical time for my 9-year-old friends and me, but it was nerve-wracking for the adults. A few days before the January blizzard struck the rural areas of northwestern Indiana, it was a balmy 65 degrees. I remember racing home from school and making the biggest decision ever. Bike or jump rope? What a difference a few days would make. On January 26, the weatherman predicted a drop in temperatures and a possible 4-inch snowfall. The outlook was not promising. That would never be enough snow to build opposing snow forts and provide an adequate supply of snowballs for a good fight. At school, we watched the snow accumulate while eating our lunchbox sandwiches and overhearing the teachers use frightening words like gust, paralyzing, stranded, and blizzard. Then sweet words came to our ears. School is dismissed. Arriving home, after what I can only describe as a death-defying bus ride, I found my mom already in the kitchen baking and preparing meals to survive the week. A short time later, my older brother Larry and sister Gloria blew through the front door, gasping for breath between shouts, "No school tomorrow!" We scurried through the house like giddy mice, searching for the things on Mom's list. Blankets, candles, shovels, buckets, and among other things, her 1940s muskrat fur coat to be used for a comforter. Dad came home from work hours later than usual with stories of whiteouts, 50-mile-per-hour winds, and deserted cars. The following day, after a record-setting snowfall of 23 inches and massive 15-foot snowdrifts, my dad and brother got to work on the snow. They tunneled out the driveway and continued into the streets of our subdivision while neighbors pressed their noses against their windows to watch. "Where does Mr. Bender think he's going?" everyone wondered. Finally, every neighbor with a shovel joined him and cleared a one-lane path to the abandoned U.S. Highway 30. Later, they formed a sled team and trekked over the tundra-like landscape to a small convenience store about 2 miles away. The mission proved a bust after finding store shelves emptied. They returned with only a few loaves of bread and a couple of gallons of milk for 12 families. Besides enjoying the week-long school closure, I still reminisce about the silence the snowstorm brought. There were no car or truck sounds roaring down the thoroughfares or airplanes flying overhead. I could only hear the echoes of laughter and screams from sledding hills and unending snowball fights. The most memorable surprise from the blizzard was my brother's larger-than-life snowman. Larry's inspiration grew after the local radio station, WJJD, out of Chicago, Illinois, advertised a snowman contest. The chosen winner for the largest snowman promoting the station's call letters would receive a free black-and-white portable Sharp TV. On the first day of building, Larry received help from Gloria and me to fill the enormous base of his snowman. Once we could only reach the top on tiptoe, we moved to the bucket brigade, filling buckets with snow and handing them to Larry while he stood on a ladder. Gloria and I surrendered early with sore backs and cold feet. We did not have our brother's determination. Within days, he finished the 25-foot-tall snowman that extended up beyond our rooftop. Larry added a red plastic bow tie, a cardboard hat and buttons, and arms made of surplus lumber wrapped in white sheets. Larry enjoyed the crowds of people streaming by to take pictures in front of his giant snowman. At last, his new TV arrived, with a WJJD broadcaster announcing over their airwaves that Larry Bender was their first place winner. Though news of Larry's accomplishments traveled quickly, so did the devastating news that my big brother had received his draft notice for the Vietnam War. I still reflect on the difference one day or one year can make. Shortly after Larry departed for Vietnam in April 1968, Northwest Indiana was hit with another significant snowstorm right before Easter. My dad suggested we build another snowman, one that would make his son proud. The 20-foot snow bunny, ears included, was hollowed out like an igloo and served as my fort for weeks until warmer temps threatened its collapse. We were the only home in Merrillville, Indiana, to have a basketball-sized clump of snow still melting on their front lawn on June 1st. Our snowman bunny didn't receive any prizes or awards, but the pictures did win the approval of some of our bravest men a world away. My brother and his buddies with the 101st Airborne Division. Our next story is submitted by Arlene Storch Rizzo, and it's titled, Little Lost Red Mitten. I was 9 years old in early February in 1949 when I received a surprise gift from my Aunt Ethel, who was also my godmother. As I lifted the lid off my present, my eyes fell upon a beautiful hand-knitted red pullover sweater with a pink heart knitted into the left shoulder. Underneath the sweater was a pair of red mittens to match. I didn't know which I loved better, the sweater or the wonderful mittens. I decided that I loved both, but most of all, I loved Aunt Ethel for knitting this wonderful gift for me, just in time to wear to school on Valentine's Day. Our fourth grade class in Herndon Looker School in Hillside, New Jersey, had a Valentine party with homemade cupcakes and little chocolates. Of course, I wore my red sweater and mittens to school that day. I felt so special and proud. Later that same February, winter came with a vengeance, including a blizzard of blizzards. The snow was so deep, we even missed a day from school. My friend Regina had a big yard with a very long driveway. Her dad and uncle piled the snow next to the drive so high that we could actually climb up the hill and slide down right into Regina's driveway. We played for hours, and it soon became apparent that one of my red mittens was gone, buried somewhere in the deep snow. We couldn't find it no matter how hard we looked. I felt sad about losing my mitten. It was so pretty and so warm. At home, I put my lonely mitten in my drawer, thinking that I would probably never find its mate. Still, I just couldn't throw it away. One evening in March, just as we finished dinner, there was a knock at our door. I opened it, and there stood Regina, holding up my red mitten in her hand. It was very wet, but very real, and still very red, after spending a month in a mountain of snow. I was delighted. March had brought mild temperatures, and the snow melted down enough on the snow pile to reveal my red mitten near the bottom. I still had many days to enjoy wearing my red sweater and matching red mittens. All through my years, whenever I have lost the mate to any matched pair of clothing or jewelry, I always save the lonely mate, remembering my little red mitten that turned up after weeks of being lost. Our next story is titled Surprise Snowstorm, and this is submitted by Sonia Holm. Life in the rural countryside of Central California was peaceful and easygoing in the mid-1940s, when agriculture and dairy farming were the main occupations there. On a balmy winter day, our family decided to visit my oldest brother and his wife, who were living in the higher foothills of the Sierra Nevada Mountains. A trip to the mountains was rare for us, so we all were enthusiastic and full of anticipation as my two brothers, my sister and her husband, my mother and I got into the brown Chevrolet sedan. It was a delightful trip along a winding mountain road, and we enjoyed the beautiful scenery as we went. Then, as we climbed to a higher elevation, it was snowing. It never snowed in the valley where we lived. We faced a question. Would we continue our trip, or would we turn around and go back home? Well, we wanted to see our brother and his sweet wife, so we decided to go on. My brother, who was driving, found some tire chains in the trunk, and after he put them on, we started up again. But now it was snowing heavily. The further we went, the deeper the snow got. When we finally reached our destination, we found we could drive only to within 2 blocks of their home. So we parked the car and started walking, single file in knee-deep snow. When you've never been around the stuff, walking 2 blocks in knee-deep snow is quite an experience. But we made a good path, each of us stepping in the footprints ahead of us. Then when we got to their house, we found they were not home. So we made our way single file again, back to the car and headed for home. By now, it had stopped snowing, so we stopped to enjoy the snow as it glistened in the sunshine, and, of course, to throw some snowballs and take some pictures of our unexpectedly snowy trip. Now, some 60 years later, looking at those pictures brings back vivid memories of that pleasant trip and the unexpected snow. Since we'll also be celebrating Valentine's Day this month, I'm now going to switch and read some Valentine's stories for you. The first one is submitted by Ruth Brown, and it's titled A Valentine for Mama. It was 1941. I was 6 years old and in first grade. Valentine's Day was approaching, and our art project at school was to handcraft valentines for friends and family. I set out to make a special valentine for Mama. First, I traced and cut a big heart out of red construction paper. Then, with crayon, I decorated it with squiggles around the edges, hoping to make it look lacy. I had just the perfect rhyme to use, too. Taking great care to print the words in my very best script, I put this message on it. I love you, little. I love you, big. I love you like a little fat pig. Living and growing up on a farm as I did, I loved all the animals, especially huggable, new little piglets. I could not think of anything more dear. On Valentine's Day, I proudly gave the valentine to Mama. She read it, but did not smile. Then she said to me, "One does not call mother a pig." I was puzzled. Such a thought had not entered my mind. Somehow, my wonderful valentine had been a flop. I still think it was an excellent verse. I suppose I am in my dotage now, but I am tempted to try using it again sometime. Perhaps I shall. The next Valentine story I have for you is titled Dazzled by the Girl Across the Aisle by Richard Whittaker. As Thanksgiving 1963 approached, I was standing in front of the festively adorned grandeur of the May Company store, where I had been an employee for a year, having started as a stock boy and then moving up to sales. My mind slid back into the past as I remembered how the journey began. In the winter of 1962, I graduated from high school and decided to attend Brigham Young University in the fall. Unfortunately, that experience lasted only 5 days, since homesickness overshadowed my desire for a college education. Then, just before Thanksgiving kicked off the holiday season, I learned that the May Company store near my home had openings for stock boys, so I decided to apply. Dressed in a suit, white shirt, and tie, I drove to the store. After identifying the location of the personnel department, I confidently rode the escalator to the second floor. Standing before the receptionist's desk, I told her that I wanted to apply for a job. She smiled and asked me to have a seat. A few minutes later, following a brief interview with the personnel manager, she smiled, shook my hand, and welcomed me into the May Company family as their newest stock boy assigned to the women's shoes department. My baptism by fire in the world of retail began as Thanksgiving approached, and on short notice, I received a promotion to a sales position in the stationery department. While working in stationery, I associated with some wonderful people, including a longtime school friend named Carol, who worked in the fashion accessories department just across the aisle. As the holidays approached, I noticed a cute, petite blonde often talking to Carol during their break time. Although she wore an employee tag and looked somewhat familiar, I felt that this little blonde beauty with the perfectly coiffed flip and radiant smile probably had more dates than she could handle, so I hesitated to approach her. However, one afternoon I slipped across the aisle and asked Carol the name of her blonde friend. "Oh, that's Cheryl Angel," Carol answered with a twinkle in her eyes. "She was a cheerleader at Grant and a semester behind us. Don't you remember her?" "Just the name, that's all." Although I often saw Cheryl when she visited Carol during their breaks, I made no effort to talk to her until Carol walked over to my counter one slow night as New Year's Eve approached and asked, "Why don't you, Cheryl, and I take a break later and get something to drink downstairs in the restaurant?" "You think she'll go?" I answered sheepishly. Carol grinned. "Well, when I told her that she needed to meet the cute guy who worked across the aisle from me in the stationery department, she smiled and said, 'I'd love to.'" Later that night, over a Coke and a bowl of split pea soup, Carol introduced me to Cheryl. When our break ended, Carol went in one direction, and I followed Cheryl to the second floor. After clocking out for the night, I asked her if she was busy the following Saturday, January 4th. She smiled and said, "No, why?" "Well, I've been thinking about going down to Wallach's Music City in Hollywood to see about buying a new Martin guitar. Would you like to go?" "I'd love to," she responded. "Where do you live?" I asked. "On Hatteras Street, near the KMPC radio towers." I began to laugh. "And you?" she asked. "I live one street away on Miranda." A look of fleeting astonishment crossed her face. "Okay, another question." She smiled, cocked her head to the side, and replied, "I'm ready." "When is your birthday?" "May the 27th, 1945, she answered. "And yours?" "May the 27th, 1944. "No, she said. "You're not serious, are you?" "I'm very serious. It appears that we were born on the same day, a year apart, attended the same junior high and high school, only live one block from each other, and we are now both working at May Company." Then, wanting to keep the mood light, I added, "There can be no doubt in your mind that ours was a match made in heaven." She blushed as we both continued to laugh. Saturday came quickly, and I had no difficulty finding her house. As we pulled away from her home, I asked, "Did you have your mind set on shopping for a guitar?" "Only if you did." "I have a better idea. I've wanted to see the movie Tom Jones for quite a while, and it's still at the Victory Boulevard drive-in. Is that okay?" "Oh, that's fine," she said softly as she slid across the bench seat in my parents' 1955 Buick. After a moment, she reached over and cranked up the volume on the radio as the song "He's So Fine" by the Chiffons began to play. Then she flashed me a quick smile. I was smitten. As 1964 rolled on, it wasn't long after our first date that Cheryl confided in Carol that I was riding down the escalator to the first floor, not long after the three of us took that break together, and in my head, I heard the words, "That's the man you're going to marry." As we dated, I would on occasion peek at her small brown 1964 desk calendar. I noted that at the time we had our first date, her social calendar included the names of 8 different eligible young men, each of whom she currently dated. By September 1st, I appeared as the lone survivor. During the next year, our romance flourished, so just before Christmas, I asked Cheryl to marry me. We set the date for January 18, 1965. We held the ceremony in the home of my parents with only 14 family members invited to attend. We purchased our wedding sheet cake from Alpha Beta for $2.50, and for a honeymoon, we couldn't afford one. To say that our life together began in a remarkable way would be an understatement. Nevertheless, after 58 years of marriage and a family that includes 7 children, 21 grandchildren, and 10 great-grandchildren, I will be forever grateful that she chased me until she caught me. And as we both look back over the years, we agree ours was a match made in heaven. And the next story I want to share with you is titled "An Engaging Evening," and this is by Sarah Baker. It was Saturday night and Valentine's Day as I entered the old town hall, scene of the annual Valentine's Day square dance. My heart was aflutter because I would spend the entire evening dancing with Bill, the man I'd been dating for the past few weeks. We had met while taking square dance lessons at a local singles square dance club, inexplicably drawn to each other and instantly hitting it off. I couldn't tell you for sure exactly what it was about him that captured my heart. Perhaps it was his sparkling blue eyes, his red hair, and neatly groomed beard. Maybe it was his spirit of adventure, his high energy, and his soulfulness. Whatever the attraction was, I didn't question it. When we danced, the world around us disappeared. Time and space lost their relevance, and I melted into his heart. I walked into the dance hall and was immediately greeted with warm smiles and friendly faces. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Bill standing with some other men at the refreshment table. Our eyes met, and he rushed toward me, picked me up, and rambunctiously twirled me around before gently returning my feet to the floor. Just then, the caller turned on his microphone, his voice cracking over the loudspeaker. "The next dance begins in 5 minutes, so gentlemen, find yourselves a partner and square your sets." Bill took my hand in his, and we formed a square with 3 other couples. The music began, as did the caller's instructions. "Bow to your partner. Bow to your corner. Alamon left. Weave the ring." Time stood still as Bill and I floated effortlessly across the dance floor, lost in our synchronized movements, unaware of anyone save for the distant sound of ladies' petticoats swishing and men's boots shuffling across the shiny wooden floor. I was on cloud 9, for we were sharing a fun and lively evening together, just as I had imagined it. But as the night went on, I couldn't help but notice Bill was acting a bit strange. He seemed uncharacteristically nervous and kept looking at his watch. As the last dance of the night was announced, Bill took my hand and led me to the center of the dance floor. The music slowed down, and just as the music was about to end, Bill got down on one knee and pulled out a small velvet box from his pocket. "Sarah, from the moment I met you, I knew you were the one," he said, his voice quivering with emotion. "You make me happier than I ever thought possible. Will you do me the honor of becoming my wife and being my square dance partner for life?" Tears welled up in my eyes and streamed down my face. I nodded and said, "Yes, absolutely yes." The crowd erupted in cheers and applause as Bill slipped a delicate ruby and diamond engagement ring onto my finger. Bill's proposal made it the perfect Valentine's Day. Bill and I married just 2 months later. We've shared a lifetime together, a lifetime filled with soulfulness, love, happiness, adventure, and the occasional misadventure. After 43 years, my heart's still aflutter because I have the privilege of dancing through my days with Bill. And now I've got some love song trivia for you. When I give you the title of the song, can you tell me who sang it? "Can't Help Falling in Love." That was Elvis Presley. "When a Man Loves a Woman." Marv Johnson sang that song. "I Love the Way You Love." I'm sorry, I got that mixed up. "When a Man Loves a Woman" was actually performed by Percy Sledge. Next song, "I Love the Way You Love." That song was performed by Marv Johnson. Next, "Ain't No Mountain High Enough." That was performed by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. "I Only Have Eyes for You." That was performed by the Flamingos. "My Girl." That was the Temptations. "I Got You, Babe." That was performed by Sonny and Cher. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. Be sure to tune in next time, and we hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.